The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Faster Mike, good afternoon. Welcome to Man in Line on Max Radio. The Chief Minister is on Man in Line today. Alfred Cannon, MHK, was elected in 2011 in the constituency of Michael, re-elected in Erin Michael in 2016 and in 2021. Previously, of course, Treasury Minister, now Chief Minister, and I just wonder what your thoughts are. Any particular questions that you'd like to put to the Chief Minister? Get in as soon as you can. Text, email, call and WhatsApp. The Chief Minister on Man in Line till 1 today. Well, Faster Mike, good afternoon, Chief Minister.
Good afternoon, Andy.
Okay, I want to dive straight in because there's a message from Ruth, who says, I've been hearing lots on Manx Radio about Moneyval and how important Moneyval is to the Isle of Man. Now, for the uninitiated, this basically is our exam regarding, well, financial probity. How seriously does the government take Moneyval?
Very seriously. Ever since this programme came into force, you know, we've been signed up to it. Effectively, for those who don't know, the Council of Europe takes a view on international responsibilities that are being followed in terms of money laundering and criminal activities by various nations, and the Isle of Man is one of the nations that will be assessed by Moneyval. It's pretty much a global standard, and following that assessment will be graded effectively. We'll either remain on the white list where we are, we could go onto a grey list or even worse, but you know, not passing the test could have ramifications for our economy and may give some headache to the, particularly that the capabilities of the economy to conduct financial transactions at its current levels.
Are you confident?
Look, we're working really hard to make sure that the Isle of Man is in the best possible shape to pass this assessment. That does involve making sure that the regulators are working properly to ensure that you know, the various sectors, financial services sector, the gaming sector in particular, are properly being overseen, are properly regulated, are properly audited. But it does also mean working in partnership with business as well. And I know there's been a big program of engagement that has taken place, and there will be further programs of engagement that will take place over the next 12 months, because part of the assessment process is that inspectors will go to businesses to see for themselves what is actually happening on the ground. So it is important, and we're having to apply ourselves quite rigorously to this, and of course there is a cost attached to this as well, unfortunately, but it is really important that as an island we get through it.
Okay, and big and small, I mean, not just big companies, lots of fairly medium-sized companies are investing. It says anti-money laundering and finance of terrorism, is that right?
Well, it's across the board. You know, if you're a regulated business, then you need to be complying with all the rules that are in place. You really got to know and be able to trace every single pound that's going through your business and identify every person that is connected with that business from a customer perspective. So there's a lot of regulation, and I think, you know, one of the issues that we're sort of dealing with at the moment is the balance between having the right regulation in place, being absolutely confident about that, and the capabilities of businesses to effectively comply with that, you know, and to ensure that we don't stamp out, for example, innovation, and that businesses are capable of moving forward. So, you know, it's quite a fine balance to achieve, but it is absolutely important that we get through this assessment. It is an important one. It'll take place in October 2026, and we're applying maximum efforts to ensuring that we do so.
Okay. We've had mention in the past, months or so, about people having difficulty opening bank accounts, businesses having difficulty opening bank accounts, CSPs having problems and what have you. Is this a trickle down from Moneyval?
I think very much so. I mean, I think the international standards that are applied, I mean, clearly they're to some degree open to evaluation by the businesses themselves, and various businesses take perhaps a slightly different risk assessment of both the processes they're following within their businesses and who they want to do business with. So it's not a perfect science, and you know, I think standards can vary from business to business. I think, as I said, you know, it frustrates me as much as anybody else to hear that it's taking weeks to get bank accounts open. That's not something that we as a government want. But we've got to balance that out with the need to demonstrate to meet international standards, and to demonstrate clearly that we've got the evidence that we are doing so. So, you know, I think the risk is shared between us as the government and the regulators, also with business themselves, who have clearly that responsibility to interpret the legislation and to determine also within themselves how they best want to address their internal operations to ensure that they believe they are compliant. So tricky at times.
Okay, one final word on Moneyval, and that is, again, Ruth just says, do you ever get any perspective on what the Channel Islands are doing regarding Moneyval?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I meet my counterparts from the Channel Islands reasonably regularly. I speak to them and have spoken to them about Moneyval. In fact, we took we worked with one of the senior leaders in Jersey who've recently passed Moneyval. He came over here and worked with our teams to assess what we were doing to try and make sure we were in the best possible shape. So yes, we absolutely keep track of our closest competitors, if you like, in terms of their approach. And you know, both of them have recently gone through the Moneyval assessment and passed. So we've got a benchmark to maintain. And clearly, I think if we didn't get the right result, that would put us possibly slightly at an uncompetitive position when it came to Jersey and Guernsey.
Okay, let's get to the phones now. And Tim is first. Hi, Tim. You're live with the Chief Minister.
Hello, Chief Minister.
Hello, Tim.
I understand that there's going to be some sort of review, or that somebody's thinking about the way elections are run on the Isle of Man. And if that's the case, I was just wanting to know, the only information, unless you're terribly keen on politics, the only information we get are the manifestos which come to us in our area. In my case, I think I'm Douglas East, or at least that used to be the name of it. So we got two lady members. But apart from them, I don't know who anybody is, really, because we don't see manifestos from anybody else in the island. So when they are appointed to be the chairman of this or the minister of that, we have no idea who they are. We don't know what their background is, where they come from, really, anything. And how can we be interested in them or even make contact with them? Or whereas I've lived on the island for nearly 40 years, and the newspapers used to be much, much better. It's the same, supposedly the same titles, but they were much keener on, there was a much more political information in them, and you saw photographs of the individuals you regularly, and you got updates of what was going on. Somehow you felt more in touch with what was going on the island and who everybody was. And if you walked down to the down to Prospect Hill, you'd actually see them walking up and down, and you could have, if you wanted to in those days, you could stop and have a word. But and all that seems to have disappeared because we don't know what they look like, we don't know who they are, we get this is the minister of that, and it means absolutely nothing. We've no idea what their background is, whether they're qualified, whether they've had any. I know you are the person that appoints them, but apart from that, I think it's all pretty sad. And There's a lot of criticism, as I'm sure you have been told about, on the man in line, about the government and so on. But I just wonder whether this isn't all a part of it. Because unless you're terribly keen, I mean, there are we've got one or two people that phone the man in line and talk in great detail as to what they know, what they've researched, and so on. But they're a bit thin on the ground, for the community in general, that doesn't really cut the mustard. And I think it's up to the politicians to do better and to tell us who they are.
Okay, Chief Minister.
Right. So just to be clear, there are no plans from this government to change the way the elections are run. So in 2026, in approximately 14 months' time, the elections will essentially be conducted on the same basis as they have over the last 10 years since we changed to the 2 MHK system. So let's just be clear on that. I think what you're sort of saying, Tim, is that increasingly you've become less aware about the individuals themselves and their backgrounds. I guess, can I just slightly ask, do you tend to use the internet, or do you tend to just rely on your information from the printed press?
I rely on my information from the printed press.
Right. So, I mean, I think I'll take on board your commentary around that. I mean, I would say that, you know, for anybody who is digitally attuned, then they can find out reams of information about particular individuals. But, Tim, I also, you know, interesting this point about what was being relayed in the press and the information that was coming across was also raised with us actually at the roadshows on a couple of occasions. You know, I accept not everybody is online, and, you know, I will take away, you know, your feedback to me that you're not seeing, you know, in writing in your press enough about ministers in terms of their backgrounds. And I'll obviously seek to find a way to address that. It's obviously not my position to dictate what is printed in the press, but we'll see whether the government can be a bit more forthcoming, if you like, around individuals' experiences and backgrounds, particularly when they're appointed. And we'll try and see whether there's a way to reinforce that.
Okay, a final word.
All right, well, just before you go, Minister, just bear in mind the point about the manifestos, because we only see the ones that apply immediately to us. We don't see anything else on the island, and it's all somebody's gone to the each of the candidates have gone to the trouble to publish about themselves. If we got the, even if we saw the records of what they had said, and they were accessible, you know, that might be helpful if they came round as a government mail shot, if you like. This is who your members are, and this is their positions, and this is their background. That would tell us something.
Okay, all right. We appreciate it, Tim. Thanks for calling today. As you say, Chief Minister, really, that, if you like, exemplifies the divide between the analogue and the digital world, because if you go to maxradio.com, we've got hours and hours. As you remember, during the election, we interview every candidate. We give them interviews. There are interviews on air. There's lots of stuff that goes out in the web, but there we are. Sadly, the newspapers are not the force they used to be, purely financially nowadays, we'll wait and see. Interesting. Of course, there's a downside to the digital world, and that's social media, Chief Minister.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it is difficult. It's really hard to communicate effectively in the digital age, and in such a way that, you know, people, can find the message, secondly, want to read it, and also that they can be totally believing that what's coming across is factually accurate.
But of course, in the digital world, you know, somebody's opinion can trump somebody else's fact. And so, you know, people's opinion seems to be more important than what an actual fact is in the digital world.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, I think what Tim and others would say to us is that they don't really actually, use the digital world. They don't go on Facebook. They don't go on other sites and forums. And actually, they do rely still on the printed press for the majority of their news. Unfortunately, yeah. You know, as we see from sales, and the newspaper will tell us less and less people are buying newspapers. But it's still, I think, the value of that medium is still relevant to many people in society, albeit perhaps diminishing. But I think we shouldn't forget that. And also, I think, you know, the point that Tim is making is terms of knowing who the politicians are on a bigger scale, just outside his two locally elected representatives, is one I'll have to consider. Clearly, we've tried to ensure that we are accessible irrespective of our constituency responsibilities. So Meet the Ministers, for example, is a classic case. I would say where we've tried to get out to ensure that a broader range of the island's population and constituent voters have sight and access to MHKs who they don't ordinarily talk to.
Okay, Julian. Hello, Julian. You're live with the Chief Minister.
Hi, Andy, and hello, Chief Minister.
Hello, Julian.
Hi. The Isle of Man government is tightening up on foreign workers who want to work on the island and go through the official process by increasing the visa application fee by 9% and giving greater scrutiny over these people. Could you give some details on the other worker status known as temporary employment exemption granted by the Department for Enterprise, which allows people to come and work on the island without going through the full visa regulatory system? What is the maximum duration for people granted such things as administrative exemption? And is there a limit on how many renewals an individual can be granted?
Well, you're absolutely right, Julian. We are tightening up on our immigration protocols in a number of areas, including on fees. We're bringing in a healthcare levy, and as you know, we're also raising the minimum level of remuneration that immigrant workers must receive. In terms of, and rightly so. I mean, I think just to dwell on that sort of broader, bigger point, the bigger issue for a second or two, you know, we absolutely recognise that as, you know, we need to fill employment gaps in our economic sectors and in our public sectors as well, that there is a case for positive immigration. But we've got to be clear that we have applied the highest standards possible to those routes, and that we are getting the right people to come to the island, and that everybody who is coming is first of all coming to proper job, proper employment, proper terms, proper conditions, and secondly that we as an island are protecting our own interests as well, both from around our infrastructure but also our security and safety. So it's absolutely right that we've tightening up on those critical areas, and we're going to continue to tighten up, particularly on our security. And then what I would say quite technical question on the technical employment exemption, I'll have to say to you, I'll have to come back, because I don't have the exact information to hand on that. And immigration routes and the pathways can at times be quite complicated. So I would have to come back to you, Julian, to answer your question, which I'm quite happy to do. If you email me that question, I will get you the information you are seeking.
Okay. What was behind the question, by the way, Julian?
Well, basically, fairness to the foreign workers. I mean, I've met quite a few of them, and they're paying a lot of money every year to remain on the island and work. You know, it's in the hundreds of pounds for visa renewals and all this kind of thing. But if there are people coming to the island that are able to go around the visa system, and there might be a question mark as to, you know, if the Department for Enterprise is granting ways around the visa regulatory system, I just feel that would be unfair to the foreign workers who are having to go through the grind of, I mean, you know, they're telling me there's massive amounts of paperwork, endless time waiting, and obviously the money involved, and now you've got a 9% increase. I'm just thinking, you know, is it fair to have this you could say there's a two-tier thing maybe going on here, where there's people on the island who are not subject to this, and you know, especially with a question mark about, you know, if they're coming from the common travel area and they're not subject to any real scrutiny coming over on the boat as well. You know, I'm kind of concerned about the fairness to the foreign workers who go through the grind of going through the official process.
Okay,
but I also, you know, understand that there are very strict limitations around the numbers of days that somebody can work. So it's only for a very, very short period of time. Is that not correct, Julian? I think we thought it was 10 days or something.
Well, there's administrative exemptions, which can go, I think, to 48 days, but then they can be subject to renewals and extensions.
I think we need to be clear though, Julian. I mean, this, you know, I'm happy to go and get the actual figures and some of the qualification criteria around this, but it is for a very, very limited period of time. And I suspect there has to be a very clearly identified need around a temporary employment exemption when you need to bring in a skilled worker who is from overseas. And I think, you know, we shouldn't seem to think, because I think there was some implication that it's some sort of backdoor into the island. Yeah. That would be a real concern to me and others if that were to be the case. But on the basis of what you've said to me today, Julian, I will go away and have a look at this specifically.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Julian.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
All right. Good to hear from you. I think, Chief, this brings me on to quite a few emails over the past week I've received. And it is concerning what is known as inward migration, or immigration, people are calling it. And because everybody, the Isle of Man is a collection of villages, everybody tends to know everybody else. So anybody new will stick out. And since COVID, we appear to have had lots of new people on the Isle of Man. Now, no doubt people left the Isle of Man after having enough of COVID, and some people have come in, and there is a feeling that the immigration on the Isle of Man is tilting just a little too far. Now, is that a bogus thought, or is it something that you pick up on from chatting to the public?
Look, I think that this has been an issue, a big issue for us, you know, for the last 6 to 12 months, and it's something that, you know, council and ministers have been really concerned about, wanting to, you know, get to the truth about, cut through the rumours and the assumptions and the perceptions. So, look, there have been one or two instances that have caused us concern, and you know, I guess at least one of those instances has been well publicised. You know, as a result, we are really tightening up on our immigration processes and applications, and that's why we have just put through and made very positive, I think, immigration statement that includes people now paying more, making sure that we've got a healthcare levy in place. That's why visa application fees have got to be designed appropriately, and of course we've raised that absolute minimum wage requirement for immigrants. I think, Andy, we had to adopt, I think, a positive immigration approach because there have been significant vacancies that have been unable to be filled by the local workforce, or indeed perhaps workforce from within the common travel area. And that has meant that some sectors, the care sector in particular, has had to go abroad to look for the workers that it needs to fill the vacancies. We need to be extremely careful about this, and we need to be absolutely on top of, you know, ensuring, as I said, that we get the right people here on the island, that the cost to the taxpayer is maintained to an absolute minimum, and of course our security remains at the highest possible levels. You know, It's been a necessity for us.
Oh, we need immigration. We need immigration.
We would not have had people to, frankly, staff the care homes or fill some of the hospital, key critical positions in the hospital, for example, nor would some of the private sector businesses have met their specific skill sets in terms of technology, for example. We need proper, positive, controlled immigration, and that's the position that we are absolutely working to. And of course, we have to remember, Andy, that immigration, outflows and inflows of people on the island, has been going on for decades, if not centuries. And even in any given year, there will be 4,000 or 5,000 people who come to the island, and 4,000 or 5,000 or so who will leave the island. So we have this flow, and that, a lot of that is driven by economic requirements. People perhaps coming to the end of contracts, coming to the end of their term, deciding they want to go somewhere else, businesses relocating them, or socially, for whatever reason, people relocating to either to the island for family reasons, or people relocating from the island for family reasons. So there's always an element of immigration going on. The fact is, I think we've seen more uptake from sort of overseas immigration applications than we have in the past, and we've not been able to perhaps fill some of the vacancies that we otherwise would have done from, if I call it the common travel area, the sort of UK, than we would have done otherwise. So, look, tight, controlled, positive, clear requirements for individuals to meet specific needs, absolutely. Proper monitoring of the situation, security first and foremost, absolute attention to detail when it comes to impact on infrastructure. And, you know, I'll be honest, we are playing a bit of catch up in some of these areas, but in no way is this an area that we have not now got a very firm grip on, and one that we recognise we're going to have to keep a grip on as things are just around us as well. And I mean, in terms of what else is happening in other economies and where we are with, say, for things like employment rates. And of course, finally, within that, it's absolutely vital that the Isle of Man continues to retain and invest in its own people and its own students and its own education system, and of course recognise and do what we can also to bring people back at the appropriate time if they've chosen to move off the island.
Okay. Mark, hello Mark, you're live with the Chief Minister.
Hi, Chief Minister. Just a quick question, really. Timor voted against the issuance of any new licence for the development of the Isle of Man gas field, as did the whole of the Council of Ministers. Can you explain why they decided, and the Council of Ministers decided, not to explore a gas field which could potentially be worth £5 billion to the Isle of Man and £2.5 billion to the Isle of Man Treasury taxpayers, given the current pressure on costs in the Isle of Man?
Well, so this vote took place initially. I think that initial vote went right back to the beginning of this administration. And actually, it did allow for the current license with Kroger to continue and to be exploited. That has clearly come to an end. The gas field, as you know, is also in the middle of the proposed offshore wind field with Ørsted. So actually, from a logistical and planning perspective, that is not an easy thing to overcome. But look, it's the position that Tim Ward adopted and the Council of Ministers has supported. And, you know, for the time being, that will be the case until politically it is either overturned or not, as the case may be. Why was that the case? I think the overwhelming political majority view at the time was that gas and fossil fuels should not be exploited, and that actually we should focus our energy on renewable energy.
Mark?
So basically, if we want to change that, we need to make sure the next general election in 2026, that if you're, you should directly ask your MHK or future proposed MHKs, are they for gas or against gas? And that should be an election issue in 2026, because it's, in my personal view, it's an absolute travesty that Tim Ward and the Council of Ministers let the island down. And it's basically the new developer can come in and it's worth billions of pounds. The gas is there. It just needs to be explored. And I think it's an absolute travesty.
Well,
that's all I've got to say.
To be clear, Mark, I mean, Kroger had that opportunity and it did not, reach, and in fact, I would argue it had that opportunity since 2018. For whatever reason, that was not fulfilled. And as I said to you, any new licensing round or any bidders clearly would have the slight problem at the moment of the gas field also being co-located in the same area and space that is currently also licensed to Ørsted for offshore wind. So I think that we need to be clear that it's not a straightforward equation, this, but the answer to your question, absolutely, if you want that overturned, then you have to have the votes and therefore you have to have that. And if that's the issue that you're looking for your MHK or future MHK to commit to, then absolutely the election is the place to get that commitment from them.
Okay, Mark, we appreciate that. I've got a message in from Texter 714. Dear Mr. Cannon, in the 2021 election manifesto, you said the lack of affordable housing was becoming a crisis, and you suggested using the Max Development Corporation to increase the supply of affordable housing. What's the government going to do about this before the next election? That's Alice.
Well, thank you, Alice. We have already built substantial numbers of affordable housing within the housing programs that have been delivered and the building that's taken place on the island. We are the first government to actually clearly set out now an objective housing need assessment, which has set a clear target for the government in terms of the numbers of affordable and social houses that need to be built over the next decade. The housing Department of Infrastructure, within whose remit this sits, continues to work with local authorities in terms of establishing and trying to understand their needs. And of course, the creation of a new housing agency remains an ambition for us, because arguably that will lead to better decision making. But we've still got more affordable houses planned under this administration, and we're going to carry on building and have still got programs in terms of planning approvals that will help meet the needs, and not least some of the building work at Lake Road, for example, where the Island Infrastructure Scheme has helped support the redevelopment of brownfield sites, and also the Manx Development Corporation, clearly the nursing home redevelopment and the future redevelopment in that Westmoreland Road area will all help contribute to us delivering on our desires to see more affordable housing available for those who want it, need it, and then of course trying to get people and enable people to get onto the housing ladder, of course.
Are you happy with the progress of the Manx Development Corporation?
Look, I think the Manx Development Corporation could do a lot more. I think actually, to be fair to them, I think the processes and of releasing land to them has been extraordinarily slow. So I've got to admit it's been a frustrating few years, because I think the plan was to allow them to get on with more government-owned brownfield site redevelopment.
Why would that be? Why is government slow in releasing land to a company it's created to exploit the land?
I think, departments have different views over the long-term strategic need of that particular piece of land, and, resolving that can take time. And clearly with wanting to get on with things, but also making sure that we don't make mistakes in terms of developing land that ultimately is then going to cost the taxpayer fortunes in the future, because, for example, you've built in an area where there was a critical piece of infrastructure could have been built and you've put housing there instead. Nevertheless, Andy, despite those frustrations, we are making quite considerable progress in a number of areas when it comes to housing and affordable housing. And I think when all is said and done, and we look back over the last 5 years, we should have seen significant numbers of private sector development alongside that, the affordable housing that would have been incorporated within that. developments, including the Westmoreland Road site and the nurses' home up and running, and some affordable housing released from within the island infrastructure scheme as well.
Okay, Denise, this is a very light question, Chief Minister. Denise said, has the Chief Minister made it up with Mr. Hooper? Because it sounded like you'd both fallen out.
Well, no.
Okay, we'll leave it there and back in a moment with the Chief Minister.
The Isle of Man Creamery presents stress-free food shopping with our doorstep delivery service. In time for breakfast, enjoy fresh milk, cheese, cream, Noah Bakehouse pastries, bread, coffee, juice, eggs and potatoes delivered straight to your door every day. And if that sounds good, we don't charge for island-wide deliveries. Love food and drink delivered super fresh? Sign up and order online today at isleofmancreamery.com.
Hi, Liz. I see you've had your garage converted.
We're desperate for more room.
Yes. Come through and have a look. John called Manx Property Conversions. We now have an extra bedroom, but it could be another reception room, kids' playroom or office. They also did our conservatory roof last year. We were so impressed, we got them back to convert the garage.
Wow, I need that. What's their number again?
Call MPC on 450500. That's 450500. Or find them on Facebook at Manx Property Conversions.
Where has a five-star selection of hand-picked quality cars?
Manx Car Store!
Where are you guaranteed a five-star friendly professional service?
Manx Car Store!
And where has five-star prices on cars covering all budgets? That's right, Manx Car Store on Kirby Farm Industrial Estate, open 7 days a week. To see their range of quality cars and over 250 five-star reviews, just visit manxcarstore.com or find them on Facebook. Manx Car Store, a place you can really trust.
On the 10th of September, the Villa Gaiety is going back to Bacharach. A dazzling tribute to the 20th century's best love songwriter. Fall in love again with the timeless music of Burt Bacharach and experience his greatest musical masterpieces performed live by incredible West End vocalists and the sensational Magic Moments Orchestra. Make sure you don't miss out. Book your tickets online now at villagaiety.com. Back to Bacharach at the Villa Gaiety. Brought to you by Mowgli Event.
Tonight at 5.30 here on Manx Radio, join Kiri Kermode and Simon Clark for Countryside.
I'll be catching up with the organisers from the Southern District Agricultural Show, and I'll also be chatting to Archie Newington from East Sussex, a travelling sheep shearer.
It was the 21st birthday, well, since the renovation anyway, of the Great Laxey Mine Railway. I speak to Joe Rock, who tells me more about the celebration and also more about the history of the Great Laxey Mine Railway.
That's all in Countryside tonight here on Manx Radio at 5.30. And don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the podcast for free at manxradio.com.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
And the Chief Minister, Afra Cannon MHK, is with us, and so is Juan. Hi, Juan, you're live with the Chief Minister.
Andy, how are you? Alf, good afternoon, how are you, sir?
Good afternoon, Juan.
Good. We've got a couple of broken wing mirrors we've left in reception for you, so you can take them home. It's a little joke from the roadshow. Alf, yeah, I'm, in the words of Star Trek, will boldly go where no man has gone before. The elephant in the room. I'm going to say the words black-coloured in Islam in these statements, so if any wokies are there, please switch off so we don't offend. You were talking there about tightening up on immigration. Quite happy to hear that. I'm sure if you're reading the room with the general public, you know their concerns of the speed of diverse culture that's coming in to parts of the island. We have some very, very clever people here working for us in the health society, coloured and black people, English-born and imported, that we need, as you have quite correctly said. It's very concerning in the north of the island that we're getting some radical views down there of these people trying to do their job in Manx care, and they're getting told to, what should we say, F off, and no wogs allowed in our houses, and a very Nazi culturism going on.
So you just explain that, Jewett. You've heard what? No, just keep the language to a minimum, if you would.
I am keeping it to a minimum, Andy, but to express something, I've got to say some form of something. We have workers there who are getting told that they're not allowed in people's houses, and certain words are being used.
Right.
we have to be very careful and mindful of where this is going, because the Manx population is watching very carefully about what's happening 60, 70 miles away from us. And now, in the last few days, we've had people walking the streets of Douglas promoting Islam. Now, if anyone has lived in any of these areas in England, in Colne, Nelson, Blackburn, we know where this could go. And I'm not saying it will, I'm not saying it is, but it could go. And the government should be very mindful of where this is heading and the speed that they are bringing in people into the island. I have two questions leading on from that, which is from David Ashford's statement the other week. I'd like to know what protections we have from any guest house here or hotel having an agreement with Serco or any other provider of accommodation within the UK for providing asylum seekers accommodation within the island, which would bypass our work permit system if they were getting paid by another government on a card or whatever. So I wanted to know what our protections were from people coming in through the back door and doing that. My second question would be, if, for example, we had a family of four living here, which had come in from, say, Africa or somewhere where a national insurance bond has not been transferred over, do all them people get automatically put on our dental register and our NHS system, as our dental register is now up to, I believe, 6,000 people looking for dentists? So I'm wondering, if these people are getting relocated here, what the government or the company that is here is offering them. I know people that have come here from South Africa who have come here willingly to work, and they said that they are so fraught that they can't get accommodation. And I mentioned this at the roadshow the other week to David Ashford, as to, is this putting a stress and pressure on our own local people getting accommodation?
Okay.
So let me just deal with the two specific questions that you've just asked there, Duan. Absolutely not. There is no legitimate basis for any company to sign any contract that would apply in the Isle of Man to house refugees or illegal immigrants at all. So Serco, as you know, have a significant contract with the United Kingdom government to house the illegal immigrants and the asylum seekers that are coming to the United Kingdom. There is absolutely no substance to any of these rumours that there are hotels on the Isle of Man contracted to Serco. None whatsoever. And I have specifically asked for this matter to be investigated, given some rumours that were flying around at the time, and I've had it confirmed back to me. There is absolutely no truth or substance to that at all. And if it were to be true, those people would be on a boat and be back to the United Kingdom as soon as possible. So that's the first point. I just want to make that absolutely abundantly clear. And then secondly, in terms of access to health, when people legitimately arrive here, they do have access, and they're employed and they have the correct visas. They do have access, of course, to the health system. And you know, that is why we have now brought in the healthcare levy for those people, which is similar to the UK, to them arriving here on the Isle of Man. And look, what I would say, Duan, is that this is a matter that we continue to tighten up on and assess. And it's almost, it is absolutely now a monthly conversation for me personally, and one in which I am continually seeking and being supplied with the data necessary to properly understand what is going on. I'm really sorry to hear those first comments that are coming through, because there is no place at all for racism in any form. Government's legitimate absolute purpose is to ensure that we have an immigration system that is fit for purpose, that we are applying that properly to meet the needs of the island on a properly assessed basis, and that assessment at the moment is around economic need and fulfilling skills gaps that we have in the workplace. And that is really purely the driver. And as I've said a couple of minutes ago, you know, we continue to keep that absolutely under review. I am also, you know, well aware of some of the atmosphere around this and some of the resentment that is perhaps filtrating across from events that are taking place across the water in the United Kingdom. Absolutely not ignorant of that, but that's why I also absolutely emphasised before that security of everybody on the island is absolutely first and foremost in my mind and in the mind of the councillor ministers, and we will always put that at the forefront of our assessments, both of immigration policy, but also our policing and ports policy as well, and how we're administrating that. And that's one of the reasons why we actually have brought a responsibility for port security into the police portfolio, and why you will see a much greater police presence now at our ports of arrival.
Okay.
Because simply, and sorry, it's a very important point, you know, we do not, and we should not be complacent of the need to protect our infrastructure on the island, protect our safety and security on the island, in a world that is rapidly changing in so many ways around us.
Just one point back on that, Andy, before you cut me off. I agree with what you're saying there, Alf, and also the fact that multiculturalism, if people come and embrace our society and look at our island as we like it and love our island, that's fantastic. They embrace that. What we don't want is people imposing their cultures on our culture, and I think that's for a lot of people on the island. We're very mindful of, we do embrace it. There's no racism from the majority of people that are here, but mindful of the people that want to come here and embrace our culture.
Okay, all right, we'll leave it there, Duan. Thanks. It's worth saying, of course, the Isle of Man is an international island. Manx people have gone all over the world for years and years and years, so we must expect people to come to the Isle of Man. Why wouldn't they? It's brilliant here. Right, this is George, who just said, can you ask the Chief Minister, now the rates reform has been declined by the ministers, can he confirm that local authorities will be given the option to opt out of the 5% reduction for ratepayers, or has this been thrown out with the bathwater? It requires a small change to clause 64, which replaces on page 31, line 2, shall with may, to make the application of an early payment discount discretional. I raised this question at a surgery with him last year. Do you remember that?
I do indeed. Thank you very much for the question. You know, I have raised that with the Treasury Minister, and that is actually now part of a consultation that is underway. Effectively, for your listeners, Andy, this was a proposition that was put to me that we should take away the rates discounts that were applied to early payers, because actually that was effectively for the less wealthy, or those perhaps who couldn't afford to pay the full amount at the time, was arguably unfair, and also the arguments put to me that local authorities were losing potentially 5% or so of potential income from those people who paid early. But look, it's a valid point, it needs looking at, and I understand Treasury are looking at it at the moment.
Okay, more questions to come that have been sent in. Lots of people always say, why do you take phone calls and never take my question? So I'll do your question. And this is, could you ask the Chief Minister, will he be standing in September 26 in Aaron Michael?
It's far too early to make that sort of assessment, Andy. I think my focus has got to be on dealing with the very many issues that are facing us as an island, in terms of everything we've been discussing today, and making sure that the economy is pushing forward, and dealing with Moneyval, and dealing with the healthcare conundrum that we're constantly battling with. Far too many issues to focus on to worry about general elections, and that would be, frankly, and I say this in all seriousness, it would be irresponsible of me, I think, in my position, to start worrying about what's going to happen in 12 months' time, because I really have, and I genuinely mean it's got a full programme of work ahead of me, and the council of ministers over the summer, and serious matters to be clear on and to point the direction on in the autumn.
Katrina says, could you ask the Chief Minister, by the end of this administration, will the situation with the DHSC and Manx Care and the overspend on the budget be sorted?
Look, I sincerely hope so. You know, as a government, we have put more money into health than I think any other government has done. And there's nearly £100 million of extra budget gone in to health, even over the last 4 years. You know, we want to see the best possible outcomes from that sort and level of investment. And bear in mind, we also did a significant restoration and recovery program post-COVID, where we put another £18 million or so into delivering over 4,000 operations for people. We've got a significant piece of work going on at the moment around governance, and I want to see some proper outcomes from that in September, including reviewing the current structures under which Manx Care is delivering its requirements in terms of maintaining its budgets, but delivering the healthcare that we all need on the island. And I don't think the conundrum is going to go away, Andy, to be perfectly honest. I think and I hope and I believe that we're going to get it under control. And that's absolutely vital for all of us, from economic sustainability and public funds. But the long-term issue of how you pay for healthcare, if needs are going to continue to grow, and I have to accept that pressure is growing, I think remains. I believe that politicians will still have to continue to assess. And I think at some point we need to take another look at how healthcare is being funded. And I suspect the question will remain for many, many years to come.
Okay, briefly, if you would then, do you think Manx Care is handling the unions properly?
Well, I would hope that Manx Care is handling the unions properly. I mean, I think that, you know, there are a number of issues that are clearly around pay that continue to dog us. Look, you know, we've got to balance out pay for doctors and pay for nurses with the overall amount of investment that the public can afford into the healthcare service. So, you know, but if we're going to have a successful healthcare service, then people need to work together, and that's absolutely imperative. And okay, they need to listen to each other.
Okay, appreciate it. The Chief Minister is going to be back before Christmas, I believe, so store the questions up until then. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Andy.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to Alfred Cannon, MHK, the Chief Minister of the Isle of Man, and we're back with an open line tomorrow. If you've got any reflections on today's programme, email maninline@manxradio.com or call the answer phone on 682-631. Thanks to Ben on the phones today.
WINT.